Isaiah, chapters 24 and 25. The 18th talk in a series on Isaiah was presented by David Crabtree on July 7, 2013 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I'm going to be picking up where I left off in Isaiah. We'll be looking at Isaiah 24 and 25 eventually, but it's been a long time, and so I'm going to briefly recap what has happened in Isaiah in the first 23 chapters. As you'll recall, this book was written over an extended period of time, but the early chapters seem to have been written in about 720 or so, 720 BC. And it was a period of time in which there was a great deal of unrest in the Middle East, go figure. And at that time, there were three kings of significant countries in the area who died and were replaced by their sons. And all of this was happening within a 2 or 3 year period. So it's, everyone can tell that there is change underfoot, but no one knows what the nature of that change will be. They just know that something is happening. Something's going to happen, and everybody's waiting with bated breath because it could be bad things happening. And when I've talked about this before, I've likened it to the Arab Spring happening now in the Middle East. I was talking about a year ago, but things have changed since then, but it's still as ominous as it was. That you can tell that there is foment. There's things happening. There's going to be significant changes. It's just hard to predict what is the nature of those changes. It just looks ominous. And that seems to have been the environment in which Isaiah was writing. And in particular, what they're concerned about is the possibility that Assyria will be resurrected, that it will become a strong empire once again, as it has been in the past. And they're thinking that this may happen again. And in preparation for that, and out of fear in the face of that, there are countries in the Levant, in the area around Palestine, that are trying to create an alliance. And they want to create as big an alliance as possible so that they think that they can hold off Assyria if it comes. And in particular, it is the countries of the kingdoms of Israel, that is the northern kingdom, and Syria have formed an alliance, and they would like Judah, the southern kingdom, where Jerusalem is the capital and where Isaiah is located and where Isaiah is prophesying, they would like Judah to join them in their alliance. And the reluctance of Judah to do so has prompted them to say, if you don't join us in the alliance willingly, we will attack you, we will take over, and we will put someone in power who will join the alliance, that will bring Judah into this alliance. So that's the situation that the king of Israel is facing, the kings of Israel, that it's more than one during the time when Isaiah is prophesying. And Isaiah's response to that at the leading of God is, don't do it. Don't ally yourself with them. I, God, will protect you. Trust in my protection and don't try to form alliances that will get you out of this problem of your own initiative. So that is the situation that the kings of Judah are facing. So Isaiah begins the book making a case against Judah, the nation of Judah, the kingdom. And his argument is they have been faithless. They have been unfaithful historically. And don't be faithless now. And there is nothing that he points to that is, to my thinking, an outrageous evil. It's not the kind of accusations where he's claiming that there is rampant and outrageous evil in the kingdom of Judah. It is rather a pervasive distrust of God, a pervasive kind of arrogance and autonomy from God that Isaiah is addressing. And Isaiah identifies, I think, the cause of that in the fact that the kingdom of Judah, the people of Judah, have refused to recognize God's loving and consistent care for them over a very, very long period of time. That God has made it possible for the kingdom of Judah to survive for centuries, and even going back to the fathers prior to that. And yet, the people of Judah have ignored that. That's not God's provision. That's just the stream of Shalom that just keeps flowing. But that's not God's provision. And Isaiah's argument is, you have refused to recognize the care that God has provided you. And as a result of that, you as a people are insecure and are constantly trying to maneuver and grab and make sure that you are taken care of. And as a result, there are wicked behaviors that come out of that. And he lists those. They are not charitable and just in their dealings with others. They are acquisitive, always trying to get more. They take advantage of orphans and widows. They worship other gods. And they are arrogant. So all of those charges are coming out of their lack of recognition and gratitude towards God for what God has done. So when you put it all together, what exists there is a deep-seated rebelliousness and faithlessness with respect to God, and a refusal to be single-mindedly devoted to the worship of God. So Isaiah says, Judah is going to be judged for their faithlessness. They've already been disciplined, he points out, and disciplined many times. And those among them in Judah who have seen that, they see that as a sign of God not loving them. But Isaiah insists it's quite the other way around. This discipline is an indication of God's love for you. If he didn't love you, you wouldn't survive your discipline. It would be much more severe. But that discipline will be, over time, ramped up as if they continue to respond with faithlessness. And, Isaiah argues, only a remnant will survive, but ultimately only a few of the people of Judah will survive. But, and something that he keeps coming back to, is that eventually Israel is going to play a glorious role in the history of mankind. Okay, so that's what he lays out in the first six chapters of Isaiah. Then he starts talking about this child. The first reference to it is a child that will be born presumably to Isaiah, who's going to be a sign of God's trustworthiness. But there are three other mentions of a child in the next two or three chapters. And it all seems to point to a child that God will send that will be a sign of God's presence on the one hand, and on the other hand will be a savior. This child will one day rule in justice and peace. And that's a theme that that will be picked up later. I think it's particularly interesting that the emphasis is placed on this one coming being a child, because you wouldn't expect someone coming to rescue the people of Israel to be a child. You would expect it to be a strong, grown individual. But the emphasis is on a child, not what you would expect. The emphasis is not on strength. The emphasis is on what kind of person this is. The next section is Isaiah 13 through 23, a long section. And that's what we talked about a year ago. We went through those 10 chapters. Those chapters are all dealing with judgment that is coming on the neighbors who are enemies to Judah. That God is going to come and visit each of those countries, and they are going to be judged. God is going to devastate them. And it goes through them one by one, and as we noticed, he picks up on themes in talking to each kingdom. He will pick up on certain themes, and those themes keep rotating through. And those themes are judgment's coming, and a lot of people are going to die. Even Judah and Israel are going to be judged, and a lot of people will die. But a remnant will remain. And out of that remnant, there will be a glorious future for Israel. And one other theme woven through that is there will be people in other parts of the world that will respond and end up glorifying God. Now, the question of when does this happen, putting a chronology to all of this, in what order will these countries be judged? Sorting all of that stuff out is extremely difficult because Isaiah doesn't seem to be particularly concerned about the chronology of those events. If he is concerned about it, his concern hasn't made its way into the text. It appears to me that much of what he says in those chapters, 13 to 23, is talking about the two invasions that will be coming soon on Israel. One of them very soon, and the other one in another 100 years or so. The one that's coming soon is the Assyrian invasion. And that will come, there will be a couple of waves of the Assyrian invasion. The other invasion is the Babylonians coming. They're coming a little bit later. But they too will sweep through those same countries. And much of the language in chapters 13 to 23, I think, is describing those invasions to come. And there'll be a great deal of devastation that results from those. But it appears to me that there is language within those chapters that is bigger language, it's more exalted language than would be attributable to either of those invasions. And there are other suggestions that what's being talked about in the midst of those chapters, in bits and pieces, is something, a judgment that's coming in the end. So I think what's happening is the Assyrian and the Babylonian invasions are dress rehearsals for an invasion that's going to come at the end of time that will be grander and will fill out the language that is not filled out by the Assyrian and Babylonian invasions. And the things that are stressed are that this judgment, when it's the fully done, the full-blown event, is going to be absolutely devastating. No one will escape. It's going to be worldwide, that all that will remain is a remnant, and that remnant is that from which God will rule the earth. But there is also hope for everyone, that Jew or Gentile, there's hope for the whole world in the midst of all this. and one needs only to turn to God for that. And lastly, the thing that Isaiah keeps stressing is none of this is unplanned. All of this was foreseen and planned by God from the foundations of the earth. God's in control of this. Everything's on schedule. God knows what he's doing. It will be disastrous, but it's exactly what needs to happen in order for God to fulfill his purposes. Okay, so that's the first 23 chapters of Isaiah. Now we're going to jump into 24 and 25. 24 and 25, 26 and 27. So the next four chapters all seem to be kind of a summary of what has been talked about in the last 10 chapters. Chapter 24 is kind of a summary of the worldwide judgment, and then chapter 25 is a description of the response of the faithful to the end of the world. So we'll look at that as well. Okay, chapter 24, the first six verses. Behold, the Lord lays the earth waste, devastates it, distorts its surface, and scatters its inhabitants. And the people will be like the priest, the servant like his master, the maid like her mistress, the buyer like the seller, the lender like the borrower, the creditor like the debtor. The earth will be completely laid waste and completely despoiled, for the Lord has spoken this word. The earth mourns and withers. The world fades and withers. The exalted of the people of the earth fade away. The earth is also polluted by its inhabitants, for they transgressed laws, violated statutes, broke the everlasting covenant. Therefore, a curse devours the earth, and those who live in it are held guilty. Therefore, the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men are left. These six verses seem to be a description in prose of this judgment, this worldwide judgment that is going to come. There is the same problem in Hebrew that Jack talked about in Greek with respect to the word for land being the same as the word for the world. And so one could substitute every place here where it says earth or where it says world, you could substitute the land. However, with one exception in verse 4, it says the earth mourns and withers, the world fades and withers. This is Hebrew poetry. Hebrew poetry typically, there is what's called parallelism. These two lines are saying essentially the same thing in slightly different words. And when it says, the world fades away and withers, the word there means the inhabited earth. So apparently this is a worldwide thing rather than just in the land. So we're talking about a worldwide devastation. And God is going to come along and lay waste to it, destroy it, distort its surface, and scatter the people that are still living on it. And then he talks about how there's going to be an inversion that's going to take place. People in positions of privilege are going to be made to be like those that are under them. So the people will be like the priest, the servant like his master, maid like her mistress, buyer like the seller. So there's a leveling effect that's happening. All of those in socially privileged positions will be just like those who don't have socially privileged positions. And we'll come back to that. That seems to be a theme in these two chapters. The earth is going to be completely destroyed, for the Lord has spoken it. Coming back to one of his themes that I've mentioned before. This is all planned from the beginning, and God says it, and it happens. Notice in verse 4, the earth mourns and withers, the world fades away and withers, the exalted of the people of the earth fade away. And this is coming back to his emphasis on those who are in privileged positions, and I'll talk more about that later. But they are going to fade away. Why is this going to happen? The earth is also polluted by its inhabitants, for they transgressed laws, violated statutes, broke the everlasting covenant. It's as a result of man's sinfulness and lawlessness that these things are going to happen. Therefore, a curse devours the earth, and those who live in it are held guilty. Then it talks about the earth, the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men are left. It is striking in the last few chapters and then coming up how often there is reference to burning, which it always seems to be an indication of judgment. So this is the devastation that's coming. The world's going to be destroyed. People are going to be killed because of their sinfulness. Now, the next section is going to introduce two images that depict this scenario. Verses 7 through, I'll go halfway through 16. The new wine mourns, the vine decays, all the merry-hearted sigh, the gaiety of tambourines ceases, the noise of revelers stops, the gaiety of the harp ceases. They do not drink wine with song. Strong drink is bitter to those who drink it. The city of chaos is broken down. Every house is shut up so that none may enter. There is an outcry in the streets concerning the wine. All joy turns to gloom. The gaiety of the earth is banished. Desolation is left in the city, and the gate is battered to ruins. For thus it will be in the midst of the earth among the peoples, as the shaking of an olive tree, as the gleanings when the grape harvest is over. Okay, there are two images that are being created here, and he goes back and forth. He starts with the image of a harvest festival, then he's going to move to an empty city, then he's going to come back to the harvest festival, and then he's going to come back to the empty city. The harvest festival is being used to depict the most joyous event in human society on a regular basis. I think that's what's being depicted here. And if we lived in an agrarian society, you would understand this better, I think, that the harvest festival is the celebration that's held at the end of the farming season. And it's significant for two main reasons. One is it marks the time at which the intensive labor that has to be conducted during the summer is concluded. And so now it's time to rest. So that's something to celebrate. The other thing to celebrate is now our barns are as full as they will be all year long. The harvest is in. We have lots of food. And that is also something worth celebrating. So harvest festivals have historically been big deals. They continue to be big deals in Munich and the Oktoberfest and other places. But historically, in agrarian societies, they were very big deals. So this is alluding to that, okay? Think of a harvest festival. But in this instance, the harvest festival turns bad. It turns sour. The new wine mourns. New wine, I think that's describing wine that has just started to ferment. Then it's made available early on in the fall, at the time of the harvest festivals, but it's just started to ferment. But this new wine mourns. And the vines, they're all drying up and decaying. And the merry-hearted sigh. So what should be a very festive occasion, it's all turning bad. The tambourines and their gaiety, it all stops. The revelers stop cheering. The harp ceases. They don't drink wine with their song. And the strong drink is bitter if they try to drink it. So it's a festival that's not fun, but it should be. It has been historically. Now we switch to the other image, a city. He describes it as a city of chaos that's broken down. And every house is closed up. Well, cities aren't supposed to be like that, and yet that's what this city is like. Now, switching back to the harvest festival again. There's an outcry in the streets concerning the wine, and I assume that means concerning the wine either because it's bad or there isn't enough of it. But the outcry in the streets concerning the wine, I suspect, is because there isn't good wine available. As a result, all joy turns to gloom, and the gaiety of the earth is banished. Now, switching back to the other image of an empty city. Desolation is left in the city. The gate is battered to ruins. The gate in a city in the ancient Near East, that was the busiest place. That was, the Saturday market of the ancient world? That's where everything took place. That's where the heart of the city, and yet it's battered to ruins. And then he likens the city to an olive tree that's been shaken at harvest time, and the farmer has shaken as many olives down as he can get. And what's left is just a smattering of olives left on the trees. Or another metaphor, the grape harvest is over, and all that's left are the few grapes that haven't been harvested. So that's what the city's like. It's completely empty. That's not the way it should be. Cities typically are busy, full of energy and activity. That's not the case here. So that's all to depict the judgment to come, the worldwide judgment. It's going to be like a harvest festival turned bad and a city become empty. Now, I think what's happening in 14, 15, and the first half of 16 is we're focusing now on those, the remnant, those who have turned to God. Let me read those verses. They raise their voices, they shout for joy. They cry out from the west concerning the majesty of the Lord. Therefore, glorify the Lord in the east, the name of the Lord, the God of Israel, in the coastlands of the sea. From the ends of the earth, we hear glory to the righteous one. So I think what he's describing here is the response of the remnant of mankind all over the world, to the east, to the west, on the coastlines, at the ends of the earth, and they are responding very differently to this that has happened. And their response is, glory to the righteous one. Okay, now the second half of 16 through verse 20. But I say, woe to me, woe to me, alas for me, the treacherous deal treacherously, and the treacherous deal very treacherously. Terror and pit and snare confront you, O inhabitant of the earth. Then it will be that he who flees the report of disaster will fall into the pit, and he who climbs out of the pit will be caught in the snare. For the windows above are opened, and the foundations of the earth shake. The earth is broken asunder. The earth is split through. The earth is shaken violently. The earth reels to and fro like a drunkard, and it totters like a shack, for its transgression is heavy upon it, and it will fall, never to rise again. Isaiah now is responding to this, and I think his response is he's seeing the judgment, but he's seeing it from a different perspective. He's not seeing it from the perspective of the remnant that we just saw. He's seen it from the perspective of one who's looking down history, and he sees what's coming. And when he sees what's coming, all he can say is, woe to me, alas for me. The treacherous deal treacherously, and the treacherous deal very treacherously. In other words, he's looking at the history to come, and he's saying, people are going to do bad things. People are going to act in accordance with their nature, and it is going to get ugly. Terror and pit and snare is going to confront everybody who inhabits the earth. No one will flee it. He says, then it will be that one who flees the report of disaster will fall into the pit, and he who climbs out of the pit will be caught in the snare. There's no way out. If you run away, you'll just get caught elsewhere. And if you try to get out of the predicament that you're in, you'll just get in another one. There is no escape from it. Then he describes the earth, and it's what happens to the earth. The windows above are opened, and the foundations of the earth shake. The windows above being opened, I'm not sure if that's describing a physical reality, or whether it is simply hearkening back to another judgment that happened. But in either case, I think it is at least hearkening back to another judgment that happened at the time of Noah. Because at that time, the windows of the heavens were opened and the waters gushed out. So I think this is alluding to the fact that another judgment of similar magnitude is coming. Now he talks about the earth and describes several things that will be true of the earth. Broken asunder, split through, shaken violently, reeling to and fro like a drunkard. So it's wandering. It's lost its way. It's lost its balance. It totters like a shack. There's no stability left in it, for its transgression is heavy upon it, and it will fall never to rise again. So I think metaphorically we've got this. And I'm not sure whether a globe was envisioned by Isaiah or not. We've got this thing that has lost its bearings. It's no longer stable and upright. It's tilting. It's vulnerable. It's wobbling. And eventually it just falls over, never to rise again. Okay, the rest of the chapter. So it will happen in that day that the Lord will punish the host of heaven on high, and the kings of the earth on earth, and they will be gathered together like prisons in the dungeon, and will be confined in prison, and after many days they will be punished. Then the moon will be abashed, and the sun ashamed, for the Lord of hosts will reign on Mount Zion and in Jerusalem, and his glory will be before his elders. So in that day, in the day of judgment, God is going to punish the host of heaven on high and the kings of the earth on earth. I'm not sure what it is referring to in the hosts of heaven, whether that is fallen angels and Satan himself, or whether it's just metaphorically talking about the powers that be on earth. It could be either. I'm not sure which. But they are going to be punished, the ones in power. Earlier in the chapter, it talked about the exalted of the people of the earth. And that seems to be an emphasis in this chapter by Isaiah. It's those who are in positions of power and prestige. They are going to be punished. They'll be gathered together into prison, be confined there for many days, and after many days they will be punished. And that all fits in with things that Jack's been talking about recently in Revelation. 23 also fits into what Jack was talking about last week in Revelation. Then the moon will be abashed and the sun ashamed, because God's glory is going to be fill Jerusalem, and it will be lit by his glory, rather than the sun and the moon. and God will be installed in his position of power in Jerusalem. Okay, so that's Isaiah's description and summary then of the judgment and what that will be like. Now, chapter 25 talks about praise for God in response to this that has happened. The first five verses. O Lord, thou art my God. I will exalt thee. I will give thanks to thy name. For thou hast worked wonders, plans formed long ago with perfect faithfulness. For thou hast made a city into a heap, a fortified city into a ruin. A palace of strangers is a city no more. It will never be rebuilt. Therefore a strong people will glorify thee. Cities of ruthless nations will revere thee. For thou hast been a defense for the helpless, a defense for the needy in his distress, a refuge from the storm, a shade from the heat. For the breath of the ruthless is like a rainstorm against a wall. Like heat in drought, thou dost subdue the uproar of aliens. Like heat by the shadow of a cloud, the song of the ruthless is silenced. So now Isaiah is singing a song of praise in response to this that God is going to do. Again, God has done this marvelous thing. It's a remarkable, an astounding thing that God has done. And it was all planned long ago. And he has carried out that plan perfectly, all as he had wanted to do. As a result, the city has been made into a heap, a fortified city. And then he says, a palace of strangers is a city no more. It will never be rebuilt. City here is a symbol. I've talked about this before, and I'll mention again Jacques Ellul's book, The Meaning of City, in which he talks about this symbol of the city and traces it through the Bible, and I think it's very helpful. But in a nutshell, the city becomes symbolic of mankind working together with other human beings, organizing their efforts to accomplish God-rivaling deeds, accomplishments. That is mankind in his autonomy, working to do God-like things. That's what the city stands for. And what happens as you see it unfolding in the Bible is the city becomes the place in which man's nature gets writ large. If you just look at one human being, you can only see a certain amount of what a man is like, what a human being is like. But you put a lot of them together, working over a long period of time on their projects, and then you start to see what a human being really is made of. He gets writ large in bigger letters. And what's going to happen ultimately is the city is going to come to be a depiction of the wickedness of mankind, the arrogance, the presumptuousness, the independence from God, the rebelliousness, all of that is epitomized in the city. So it's significant then what Isaiah says. He's taken the city and he has reduced it to ruins. And the fortified city, remember who built the first city and it was a fortified city? That was Cain. And it was Cain, after he had killed Abel, running away from God and building a city for his own protection from God. Well, the fortified city is destroyed. Then it says, a palace of strangers is a city no more. And I'm not sure what it means by a palace of strangers. It seems to me that there are a couple of possibilities. One would be that it's talking about within the society of Judah, that there are there's a palace in the city, or a network of palaces, where the ruler and his family and his friends, advisors, stuff, where they inhabit. And why would it call them strangers? I think it calls them strangers because they act with respect to their people as if they were not their own. They are there to be victimized and taken advantage of, rather than being family, being those that we are to care for. That's possible, or it seems to me it's also possible that it's talking about Assyria or some conquering nation, that it's the palace of foreigners that oppress us. In either case, that will be destroyed as well, and never will it be rebuilt again. And it will come to the place, verse 3, where a strong people will glorify thee, cities of ruthless nations will revere thee. So even the reluctant, even the ones who are slow to recognize who God is and what he's doing, will be forced to admit that, be forced to recognize God is the one who provides. God is the one who saves. God is the one who rescues. And I don't know whether what's being described here is a genuine change of heart, or whether it's a reluctant response to the realities of history. I'm inclined to think that it's a genuine change of heart insofar as it uses the word glorify in the first half of the verse. If that's what it's describing, I think what it's saying is even those coming from nations who have been bent on the destruction of Judah, that they will come to glorify God as well, at least some of them. Then he talks about the nature of God's defense of the helpless and the needy, that God is the one who defends them. And there's a sense in which what he has in mind here is Judah, but I think it has wider application, and I think he intends it to have wider application. God is the defense of the helpless, a defense of the needy, a refuge from the storm and shade from the heat. So two images here. One is shelter from stormy weather, and the other is shade from burning heat. And God is the source of both of those forms of refuge, such that the breath of the ruthless is like a rainstorm against the wall. The breath of the ruthless does nothing. It cannot penetrate God's defense. God's defense is sure and complete. Like heat in a drought, and like heat by a shadow, that God is able to remove them both quickly, easily, and without a lot of fanfare, actually. So God is going to use his powers to subdue the uproar of the aliens and to silence the song of the ruthless. So that is a song of praise that Isaiah is proclaiming to God for what he does and is going to do. Now he's going to talk about another banquet, a banquet that is far superior to the harvest festival. Verse 6. And the Lord of hosts will prepare a lavish banquet for all peoples on this mountain, a banquet of aged wine, choice pieces with marrow and refined aged wine. And on this mountain he will swallow up the covering which is over all peoples, even the veil which is stretched over all nations. He will swallow up death for all time. And the Lord God will wipe tears away from all faces, and he will remove the reproach of his people from all the earth, for the Lord has spoken. So now there's going to be a real feast. This is going to be a huge, a grand feast with lots of the very best that is all being provided by God for all peoples on this mountain. And not only will there be this large feast, and this probably this the banquet that he's describing here in all likelihood would be a banquet that's used to mark the beginning of a reign. This is marking the beginning of God's reign in Jerusalem. But not only will there be a banquet, but what God is going to do is he is going to swallow up the covering or the veil which is stretched out over all the nations. That is death, death and futility. He's going to swallow up death for all time. He's going to wipe away the tears from all faces. And he's going to remove the reproach of his people from all the earth. So death is done away with. Our reproach is removed. Okay, the last four verses. And it will be said in that day, behold, this is our God for whom we have waited, that he might save us. This is the Lord for whom we have waited. Let us rejoice and be glad in his salvation. For the hand of the Lord will rest on this mountain, and Moab will be trodden down in his place, as straw is trodden down in the water of a manure pile. And he will spread out his hands in the middle of it, as a swimmer spreads out his hands to swim. But the Lord will lay low his pride together with the trickery of his hands, and the unassailable fortifications of your walls he will bring down, lay low and cast to the ground, even to the dust. So continuing in praise for what God has done, this is the God for whom we have waited that he might save us. That it has finally happened, that the God to whom people throughout the world had looked to for salvation for so long, he has moved and he has acted on their behalf. And he has moved in judgment. So he says, let us rejoice and be glad in his salvation. So this is the fulfilling of the hope that people have had for so long. And God is going to place his hand on his mountain, rest his hand on his mountain. He is going to come to rule in his mountain. But Moab, the nation next door, and Moab has been singled out for quite a bit of derision through the last 10 chapters. And I'm not entirely clear why Moab would be singled out for so much of the judgment, but it is. Moab, on the other hand, will be trodden down as straw is trodden down in the water of a manure pile. And then he, that is Moab, will spread out his fingers as if to swim in this muck. It's a pretty graphic image. Moab will be reduced to such a low level that he will be swimming in sewer water. God is going to lay him low, and the unassailable fortifications, and there were several references to that in the previous chapters, that Moab thought that it was so well protected that nobody could bring them down, could capture them. And God is saying, the unassailable fortifications of your walls, he will bring down, lay low, and cast to the ground, even to the dust. So the destruction of Judah's enemies will be complete and utter. Okay, I'm going to try to encapsulate what these two chapters are about. And I think I'm going to be able to describe it in a way that is faithful to what Isaiah is saying. Essentially, mankind can be divided into two groups, and there are two different fates that await the individuals in those two groups. The first group I'm going to describe as those who are invested in this life. And what I mean by that is these are people who look to this life and what this life provides for their fulfillment, for their satisfaction, for their happiness. They are the ones who are invested in this life. This has to give it to them because otherwise they aren't getting it. As a result, these are people who want to wring happiness and fulfillment out of everything. They're desperate to find it and get it, and they do everything they can to wring a little bit of happiness and fulfillment out of every aspect of this life. And this becomes their primary goal. So these are people who live for the harvest festival. They live from year to year for the harvest festivals that come and give them an opportunity to gain some happiness. And in this chapter, he seems to be focusing on the most successful and powerful, the exalted people, that they are the ones who epitomize this being invested in this life. My suspicion is that what Isaiah is noticing is that those who rise in power, those who are successful in this world, are oftentimes those who are invested in this world. You become successful because you pour everything into that venture. And so the people in those positions of power and influence tend to be ones who are invested in this life. I'm sure you're all aware of that phenomenon that people in power tend to use that power for their own advantage. And it is, to me, always disappointing when I hear stories of our elected officials in positions of power using their power in a way that is designed to benefit themselves and their friends. I think it is probably the case, I don't know this for sure, but I think it's probably the case that because of our heritage and our values that there is less of that corruption in America than there are in many countries. But I suppose that's why it's particularly disappointing to me when I find out that there are instances of that happening in our midst. But it is a phenomenon that we're all aware of, and I think this is the phenomenon that Isaiah is pointing out, that people in power and influence tend to be those who are heavily invested in this world. I think that Isaiah, though, would go on to say that even a homeless person can be invested in this world. You don't have to be the rich and powerful to be invested in this world. Anyone can be. It's just a question of where you look for your fulfillment and your happiness and what you're willing to do for that. The homeless person lives from one bottle of happiness to the next, but is just as much invested as a rich person. So I think he would say that those invested in this world ultimately are all of those who are living from one harvest festival to the next. And what awaits those who are invested in this life? Those celebrations will come to an end. Those celebrations were never all that satisfying in the first place, but they're going to come to an end. And what's going to replace those is terror, destruction, and judgment. And the world that they've invested in is going to teeter and just fall over. What they've invested their whole lives in is temporary and not very stable. So that's one group and their fate, the fate that awaits them. The other group is those who have invested in eternity. These are the ones who expect to be fulfilled, not in this life, but their fulfillment is coming in God. God is the one who will save them. God is the one who will give them meaning, fulfillment, and happiness. They are the ones that throughout this life have patiently waited for God. They're the ones that recognize that life is a century-long experience in delayed gratification. They're the ones that wait patiently. They recognize that God will provide fulfillment in his good time. They're the ones also who have come to value righteousness. Notice that when their praise to God is glory to the righteous one. So it's people who have come to value righteousness and have come to recognize that what life is about is pursuing that which is good and right and just and true, and that takes precedence over doing that which temporally will make one happy and fulfilled, or they hope it to do so. And God looks out for those that pursue righteousness. God is their refuge. God's taking care of them. He's the refuge for the helpless. He's the refuge for the needy. He's the refuge from the storm. He's the shade from the heat. All of these are themes that come back again in the Beatitudes, in the Sermon on the Mount. It is easy to think that I am the only one that really cares about my interests. And as a result, I'm the one that has to look out for those interests. But the perspective that Isaiah is presenting is that is not true. That God is interested in your interests. He will protect them. In fact, he is better at doing that than are you. So if we pursue God and doing that which is true and good, we can rest assured that he will take care of our interests. He will look out for those and provide the refuge that we need. And that creates a kind of freedom and a freedom from care that we cannot otherwise get. It's an amazing thing that God will take care of us and we don't have to worry about that. What awaits them? They'll get their own celebration, a permanent celebration, a true celebration, one that is worthy and satisfying, a celebration that will have the best of everything. And death will be removed. And I think Isaiah would say both physically as well as spiritually. And reproach will be removed. And these, the downtrodden, the ones who weren't invested in this world, will, at that point in time, be shown to not be losers. They've always looked like losers all life long. But in the end, it will be shown that they are not the losers. They're the winners. Okay, those are the two camps into which Isaiah has divided mankind and the two different fates that await them. And I think it's describing primarily, and I think Isaiah intends this to be primarily a spiritual reality that's being described. But given the clues from the previous 10 chapters, I suspect that there is a physical reality that comes along with that. That is to say that Israel in history, in a sense, becomes a depiction of the downtrodden, the picked on, and that in the end, Israel will be saved by God and shown to be the winners and not the losers that they have appeared to be throughout all of history. So I think there is a historical reality that accompanies this, but the spiritual reality is the one I think is primarily being highlighted here. Okay. Questions or comments?
In 24, verse 5, particularly where it says, broke the everlasting covenant.
Mm-hmm.
I find that really hard to believe, that Isaiah is just talking about the world and not Israel, is kind of a fact that it didn't say covenants, but rather specified a very specific covenant with a definite article.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I'm tempted to kind of take the first six verses as kind of building on the pre-established picture of Israel's destruction, is kind of to show what the destruction of a world will be.
Mm-hmm. And that's possible. I'm inclined to go the other direction. The reason I'm inclined to go the other direction is, first of all, the use of the word tevel here, which means the inhabited world, in verse 4. And for the everlasting covenant, I'm inclined to think that that's not talking about the covenant made between God and Abraham. Is that what you're thinking about?
Yes.
I'm inclined to think that it's not talking about that covenant. That I suspect that what's in view here is a kind of implied covenant between God and all of mankind. That is, when we were made by God, God made us to be moral beings. He made us to be spiritual beings. And he built into us a conscience. And that we, that is, mankind as a whole, has violated that standard of righteousness that is built into us as human beings. I'm inclined to think that that's more likely what he's talking about. And I go there because I think this is a worldwide judgment. But I can understand why you would go the other way. Those kinds of judgments are a little bit difficult as you go through interpreting these passages.
In 24, you brought out that fire is judgment. And then later in, I think, 16 through 20, that picture of judgment where the high up the windows were open. Mm-hmm. And you reference that to maybe Noah.
Yeah.
I guess I'm a little confused about if fire is judgment, what would water represent with Noah?
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I've thought about that. That's a good question. And I'm not sure that I know what that is. Why did God use water when he judged the earth the first time with Noah? The fire is clearer, I think. It is a long-standing symbol of cleansing, purification.
Well, yeah, everything from Sodom and Gomorrah to hell.
And even outside of the Jewish tradition, mm-hmm. I think it's interesting, in the Odyssey, after Odysseus kills all the suitors,
yes.
They clean it with brimstone and fire.
Forgot about
that. And so that's an international symbol for judgment. So that makes all kinds of sense. What is water doing? And I don't have a good answer to that, but I think there is one. I just don't know what it is yet.
And the next thing I want to, I guess, make a comment about. In 25, I believe it's verse 2, you're talking about the strangeness or whatever, that it might be the royal family or right. Actually Assyrians.
The palace of strangers.
Yeah, palace of strangers. I saw a very interesting video on Marie Antoinette, mm-hmm. and they went very detailed into the etiquette of the palace. And I'm a little bit of a historian, and I've studied a lot of the different types of attitudes of royalty and so on. And it seems clear to me that what happens a lot of time is initially it's for the good of the people, but over time it just becomes a us and them. And I was particularly, I don't say, interested how sometimes morals are almost flipped, and what's private and what's public are almost flipped. And so it's just, and how so many people that were not so heavily invested in court etiquette were very disenchanted or didn't like court life. It was much too artificial, whereas how the other people lived was much more real to them. And so that makes me inclined to go to kind of the first thing that he's talking about, the royalty of...
In their own midst.
In their own midst. Because even with David and then Solomon, you can see the beginning of that when he, all his wives and so on.
Oftentimes that pomp and ceremony that surrounds a king really originates from insecurity. That there's always the question, what gives you the right to tell me what to do? And so ancient societies tried to elevate the king to be something other than just one of us so that there was legitimacy built into it. Why does he have the right? Because he's not one of us. He's a god. He's whatever. And so it's an attempt to try to create a sense of legitimacy surrounding someone in power. But one of the side products of that is distance is created. And they're no longer the same people. They're no longer linked that way. That's very interesting.
Yeah, one time it just became clear to me when I was reading about when Samuel anointed Saul, and then they found him, the things they said about him was, oh, he's so tall, he's so handsome.
Yeah, he's got all the trappings.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, legitimacy, that question of legitimacy of rules, a very interesting question historically.
Dave, I got two things, but the first one I was going to ask last week when Jack was describing the eternal life that we are striving to inherit someday. As a child growing up and even well into my adult life, obviously, I must have had a wrong paradigm of just exactly what heaven was. Mm-hmm. Because I was taught that heaven is our goal. And then you're trying to get in your mind exactly what a picture of that heaven was. And, you know, as a kid, it's like, well, we're floating along in air or something. But then as an adult, it was, well, and I'm supposed to be praising and glorifying God 24/7. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, how's that ever going to happen? Question that I have is, you talked about fallen angels today, and I think Satan was one of those fallen angels. So a question came, well, if heaven was our goal, then how in the world can we get kicked out of heaven? That was something that didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. So when we talk about the eternal life that we're going to inherit and to be in a perfect relationship with our King Jesus and with each other, I'm assuming once there that relationship is permanent. You understand what I mean?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So anyway.
Yeah.
Just a comment.
I'll just respond very briefly. I don't know what heaven's going to be like.
Right.
I think the descriptions that we have, for the most part, are all putting it in symbolic form. And that's interesting symbolism, but I don't think it tells us much about what heaven is going to be like. And I personally prefer not to really envision it all that much, because no matter what I do to try to envision it comes out a little bit insipid. I trust that God knows what it should be like, and he's preparing it, whatever that is. Now, with respect to the fallen angels and stuff, that is all very strange to me. I don't understand what could be going on there, what could be described there. I've always kind of shied away from it. But it could very well be the case that Satan and some angels fell. But I assume that they are in a different situation than we will be in, because we have been tested through an experience of living life in a way that apparently they had not been. But in any case, the Bible seems to make it clear that our status is not questioned, that we will not be thrown down from heaven at a later time.
And my other question is related to your comment of those that are invested in this life versus those that are invested in an eternal life. And I sometimes find myself looking at this world and thinking that it and my life and really enjoying it or just kind of basking in its beauty and its the relationships and that type of thing. And you can't get away from your sinful nature, but I'm not saying that, but a lot of times the bad stuff that's happening and the evil and whatever, it's almost like you're becoming isolated from it and you don't feel it as you would if you were involved. And not even just evil, but tough times, just trials and tribulations of any type. And so what I'm saying is it's hard to know exactly where that balance is. You know, we're living in this world. We have to earn a living in this world. We have to participate in it. And yet we have to have a different goal and a different aspiration. Sometimes it's easy to talk about it. It's just hard to live it. I find it hard to live it sometimes. So.
Right. No, absolutely. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with enjoying this world. To enjoy this world is not the same as being invested in this world. The reason I used invested is because there's a desperation there. This is where I have to get my happiness and my fulfillment. And that's what distinguishes those who are invested in it from those who are not. Both can get some happiness from it. And in fact, probably those who are not invested in it are better positioned to get happiness out of it than those who are invested in it. Because you're freed up. It doesn't have to completely satisfy you. Our fulfillment is yet to come. There may be happy moments here, and absolutely there are. God created a beautiful world for us to live in. And there are many phenomenal things here. And there's nothing wrong with enjoying those. There's only something wrong with investing yourself in those. That you're desperate to get happiness and fulfillment out of those. That's what's wrong. And now, what you say, that line between living in this world and enjoying what comes along and being invested in it, that's a line that we have to re-examine all the time, because it's so easy to move from one into the other. It's so easy to get invested in what's here. And to be on guard against that is just the part of life we have to be. And be praying that God will make us attentive to the problem and aware of when we are becoming invested in this life.
In verses 1 through 6 is the word that they translate, earth, world. Is it consistently the same word, just translated different each time?
It is. My recollection is that in every case, it is Eretz, except in verse 4, where my translation says, the earth mourns and withers, and then the world, and there it's Tevel, which means inhabited world.
Could this not be a passage equating the people of Israel with the evil of the Gentile world? The people will be like the priest in verse 2. Mm-hmm. That sure sounds like a description of Israel, not the Gentile world.
Right.
And well, it could be. In 6, where he says, and a few men are left, that to me sounds like the remnant mm-hmm. that's always promised to the Jews, but not to the Gentiles. Be saying, you of all people should be a different people than the Gentiles, but you're not. And so just like they are all going to be treated like one group, you're going to be treated just like them in judgment. Fire will burn, the guilty will be taken away, and in your case, a few will be left.
Mm-hmm.
You were given the laws, the statutes of the covenant. They weren't.
Mm-hmm.
So why aren't you different?
Mm-hmm.
And he's sort of, just being a Jew is not going to protect you. So just as the inhabited world's going to face judgment, so will the land face judgment. I mean, that's kind of mm-hmm. how it reads to me, but then mm-hmm. I don't have the...
But it is, but as you're seeing it, it is a worldwide judgment in which Israel's in the midst of that, and that he's focusing in on Israel in those verses, possibly.
Mm-hmm. And so this is what we just talked about in Revelation, right? This is the end. This is the last act.
I think
he's
so.
Talking about.
I think so.
And so he's not talking about Assyria, the Chaldeans. He's not talking about judge. He's saying in the last act, this is how it's going to play out.
Right.
And it turns out to be pretty good.
For some.
For some, yeah.
Okay, thanks.